I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
Humor and crime go together like, you know, peanut butter and chocolate.
I wanted to really lean into just that eeriness.
As soon as I was able to read, I was very interested in what university would be like.
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
Kate Hilton and Elizabeth Renzetti know what it's like to start over at midlife. So when they co-wrote the mystery novel Bury the Lead, they gave their lead character, Kat Conway, a major league start over to contend with. Kat has a midlife implosion. She loses her big city journalism job and ends up back in her hometown writing for the local newspaper. And because this is a murder mystery, pretty soon a local luminary ends up dead and the town's secrets start to reveal themselves. Kate Hilton and Elizabeth Renzetti, the co-authors of Bury the Lead, opened the program today. Solving a murder mystery is one thing, but the puzzle of human nature, now there's a real challenge. A university campus is a place of big questions and lots of small ones. What do I want to do with my life? And which party do I choose to go to tonight? Plus, throw in academia with its juicy mix of intrigue and competition, and you have fertile ground for novelists. The campus novel has a long tradition, and our columnist Talia Cleott closes the program today to tell us about three that she recommends. And in a half an hour, our contributor Ryan B. Patrick brings us an interview with Louisa Onome. She's the author of Pride and Joy, a story of a Nigerian-Canadian family and their unusual countdown to Easter Sunday. I'm Ali Hassan. Welcome to the next chapter. What comes to mind when you think of cottage country? Sleepy towns filled with an unlimited supply of butter tarts, leisure and relaxation by the quiet lake? Well, that's where Kate Hilton and Elizabeth Renzetti's new novel, Bury the Lead, takes place. But this town isn't the hot dogs and screen doors type. It is an escape for the wealthy, filled with pizza ovens and basil gelato, and a place where dark secrets linger below the surface. Bury the Lead is the first book in the new Quill and Packet mystery series. It follows a disgraced journalist, Kat Conway, who's returned to Port Ellis to work for a local paper after a bad divorce. One of her first assignments is to interview legendary actor Elliot Fraser, who's the lead in the town's latest theater production. But when Elliot ends up dead on opening night, Kat finds herself in the middle of an unraveling murder mystery where everyone is a suspect. Kate Hilton is a writer, therapist, and author of three novels, and Elizabeth Renzetti is a journalist, author, and a former columnist for The Globe and Mail. They join me now in our Toronto studio. Hello, and welcome to the next chapter.
Hello, Ali.
Hi, Ali. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So, Kate, let me ask you first, where did the idea for this novel come from, and how did you team up with Elizabeth to write it? I ask that from a personal perspective as well, because Elizabeth, I've read Shrewd, which was a collection of essays in a totally different light. So I'm very interested to see how you both teamed up.
Well, Liz and I are friends. You know, we are part of a small group of writers who get together, kind of a writer support group, you might say. And during the pandemic, Liz and I were gathering together in a park to talk about how difficult it was to read and to write and how bleak it all seemed. And it turned out one of the things we were doing to sort of get through the long, dark days was reading mysteries. And we discovered that we were both huge mystery fans and had been since childhood. And it struck us that maybe we should try to write a mystery together. So that was the impetus for trying out this project.
That's a great sales pitch for writing groups, certainly. Elizabeth, what was the co-writing process like for you?
At the end of it, I thought, why don't all novelists write as a team? It's just, you know, I don't want to compare us to oxen, but kind of when you have two oxen together pulling a plow, it is so much easier than one. And Kate is the most generous partner I could ask for. Our sensibilities are
very much aligned. Our writing styles are very much aligned. We both kind of have a wry look at the world. So I would say if you're going to choose a writing partner, in the same way that you would choose a romantic partner, make it somebody you will be happy to spend a lot of time with. Mm. We wrote an outline. We wrote character studies. And then we just kind of alternated chapters. And it proved to be incredibly smooth.
So this novel is a very smooth novel. I will agree that it's a smooth read. It takes place in Port Ellis, which is a small town, a three-hour drive away from Toronto, where the rich go to escape. One of the characters describes it as Goodfellas with Muskoka chairs. It also has, obviously, the Stratford and Shaw sort of festival vibes there. Why did you decide to set the story here, Kate? Let me ask you.
So it's a mashup of Ontario holiday towns, right? I grew up with a cottage property and my family in Muskoka. So that's a landscape that has a real pull for me. And some of those piney, rocky, lakey kind of feelings seep into the book. But of course, you know, Ontario has Shaw and it has Stratford. And that's really part of the summer experience of being in southern Ontario. So that's why it has a bunch of distinctive Ontario summer qualities to it that we were interested in.
Elizabeth, our narrator, Kat Conway, is recently divorced. Her teenage son doesn't want to spend time with her.
I don't know. I know nothing about any of those things.
Those things? Okay. Perhaps, you know, in your imagination somewhere, you can dig it. She's just lost her high-profile job after getting into a physical altercation. I'm hoping you don't know about that for real.
I do not.
What inspired her character?
Well, I think we were both, Kate and I are both women in midlife, and I think we were both very interested in that period when you can kind of feel like you disappear, both personally and professionally, that the world has lost interest in you because you're no longer a hot young thing. And that's where Kat finds herself. She's her marriage is on the rocks. Her formerly high-profile career is in tatters. And she has to reinvent herself, which is, as everybody who writes fiction or makes any art knows, is the most fertile period for an artist, is when your character is going through a period of reinvention, because they can either dive bomb into the ocean or they can spread their wings and soar, and she has to figure out a way to soar. And the second thing she has to do is to find a community, which she does in this small town newspaper that she goes to work for, reluctantly goes to work for.
Kate, the story centers around the murder of Elliot Fraser. Mm-hmm. He's the lead actor in the Towns Theatre production of Inherit the Wind. And it's pretty clear off the bat that Elliot abuses his power and his fame. What did you want to say about men like him and the structures that hold up men like that?
I love that question. So Liz and I are both lifelong feminists. So we've been, you know, Liz has written extensively about the Me Too movement and structural power abuses by men. I think mysteries give you an opportunity to exercise your own brand of justice in the little world that you're playing in. There's sort of an orderliness to a mystery that allows you to create a world as you think it should be. And so, you know, there's a reason why Elliot Fraser, notorious skirt chaser, finds himself dead early in the book. It's on the cover copy, no spoilers. Because he's the sort of person who sort of has it coming. And we were interested in exploring what it means for someone like that to die in a murder mystery, and the whole array of suspects that then appear, because a lifelong experience of abusing power leaves a lot of people around you who would be happy to see you go.
As soon as he looked down Kat Conway's shirt, I was like, this guy's going to die.
Done for.
Yeah. I don't know why that was the death.
It actually did happen to me once, but yeah.
Elizabeth, in this type of genre, how do you navigate around writing about sexual assault?
Yes, it's actually really tricky. And I kind of tried to draw a little bit. You know, when you're a reporter and you're talking to people who have been involved and who are survivors of, let's say, domestic violence or sexual assault, you have to take a really trauma-informed approach to talking to them. So in fiction, you have more liberty because you can imagine your way into the minds of people who have suffered like that. And a lot of, I think, what we wrote about was underpinned by the reporting I'd done, but you also get to
imagine places that you couldn't go when you're talking to real people because it's too painful for them, it's too difficult, things like that. So it kind of was a wonderful exercise in exercising your fiction writing muscles.
Kate, you had to enter this world of crime reporting and this world of theater. I mean, did you have to do a fair amount of research on both of them?
Well, I had such a great partner in Liz. On the theater side, theater is a huge love of mine. I didn't work in that field, but I've been an appreciator of theater and consumer of theater for most of my life. And so that piece was really fun. And of course, Liz has a lot of behind the scenes stories from her career in reporting, which is fun. And similarly, on the crime side of things, I've been very interested in true crime. I've been very interested in mystery writing for a long time. And so it was fun to just be able to enter that world. I mean, fiction writing lets you do that, to enter mm-hmm. different worlds. I'm someone who's had a lot of different careers, so I'm quite familiar with dropping into different worlds. I actually started my career in law, so the sort of world of justice and crime is not unfamiliar to me in that sense.
Elizabeth, in your case, you were familiar with much of this. How do you balance both the dark and the humorous aspects of this story and make it seamless?
I am firmly of the Mary Poppins, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down philosophy of life. Mm. And it was, I used that in my columns as well, which is that you can use humor to make very serious points. And it's not off-putting for readers. You know, you kind of welcome them in gently with humor. In this book, with kind of sardonic wit, Kat's point of view is quite wry, I would say. And in that way, you bring people in, and then you can kind of gently give them the darker material. I think of all the writers I love who blend, like Hilary Mantel blends dark, dark, dark humor and dark material, or Martin Amis, people like that. Humor and crime go together like, you know, peanut butter and chocolate, if you ask me.
With apologies to those with peanut allergies,
yes.
But I fully agree with you. On that note, Kate, Kat is surrounded by this cast of, you know, quirky, charming friends, colleagues, performers, former flame, you know, as she works to solve this murder. So tell us more about these sidekicks who you created and brought in.
So I think sidekicks are so important in a mystery, particularly if you're setting up a series, because there has to be sort of a little village of characters who travel along with you. Because the B plots in a murder mystery are really about those relationships, right? How is your main character developing as a human? And that piece of it, you learn through her relationships with other people. And so in the Quill and Packet office itself, which is this tiny little community newspaper, you know, there's Bruce, who's an aging hippie and who is sort of a jack of all trades in the newspaper business, of a type that is dying out. But the person who can, you know, set the ads and take the photographs and knows everyone in town and can follow a rumor. There's a millennial named Cadence who's responsible for trying to pull the paper into the 21st century by having a social media presence. There's a very elderly owner of the newspaper who is always threatening to sell it, right?
Dorothy, yeah.
Dorothy Talbot, who's a member of one of the founding families of the town. And then there's Amir, who is an old childhood friend of Kat's, who has been brought in from also a larger city paper in Vancouver to try to save this newspaper and make it a going concern.
And Elizabeth, a hallmark of a good whodunit is the clues.
Mm.
So how do you manage that, giving enough information but still building suspense, right? We have to suspect everyone.
Yeah.
And you know, throughout every chapter, and I went through this, it's this person. It's clearly this person. And then the next
good.
Chapter, yeah, no,
so
actually
good.
It isn't. Now it's this person. I know that because why would they have mentioned that? And then it as quickly as you get it, it goes as well. So I wanted to know.
Well,
I
enrolled in the University of Mysteries at a very young age. When, you know, my parents gave me sort of Ed McBain novels, probably inappropriately, when I was about 8 years old and started to read them. And ever since, I've been reading mysteries ever since. And you just sort of, I think you develop a kind of instinctive feeling for how you hide things, like in an Easter egg hunt almost. And then you just have to be very deliberate and kind of mechanical about it when you do it in your own writing. And you do a first draft and you maybe give it to a couple people, like, for example, Kate's husband to read. And he'll say, I think maybe it's so-and-so. And then you say, okay, I think we need to put in some more clues and take away some other clues. Mm. And then that's what you do. And you add and subtract until your readers really are befuddled and have no idea until the very end.
You feel kind of ashamed, or at least I do, because Agatha Christie was my gateway drug into mystery. And you think, having read so much mystery, by now you should be able to see a pattern mm-hmm. and you should be able to figure it out. And you still can't figure it out. Maybe that's why people are drawn to
it. I can't do math, so there you go. That's my...
Motherhood is a recurring and unifying theme, I would say. So without giving too much away... Tell me, in what way do you relate to the mothers in this story? Kate, I'll ask you first.
In so many ways. Both of us are mothers. It's such a defining identity. Once you have kids, there's no way to sort of erase that part of your identity. And you realize you never stop being a parent. And that's sort of a theme in the book as well, that anxiety and protectiveness and desire for your child's success, it just follows you for the rest of your life. You never graduate from it. And so we were interested in that. It's a compelling part of both of our lives. And we've both gone through phases with our kids when they were struggling and when relationships between the kids weren't exactly what we wanted them to be, between the kids and ourselves. And I'm a divorced person, so I'll own that. And that creates some tension in your relationships with your kids. So we wanted that in the book. We wanted that to be part of Kat's struggle and growth, was how do you make that relationship okay?
How about you, Elizabeth? How do you relate to the motherhood in this story?
We put so much pressure on mothers in this society, and I think really to the detriment of everyone. And we also kind of view that relationship as so fundamental to your personhood, to your sense of self, to your status in the world, so that when it's not going well, you really feel like, okay, who am I as a person if I can't even, raise this person properly and have them love me? But then you realize, and Kate's been very good sort of helping me just personally walk through this, that, adolescence, especially in the book, Kat's son is an adolescent, and we both have teenagers, Kate and I, it is a period of divergence, right, from yourself. They are forming themselves as people, and you can't take that as failure. It's not a failure. You're not a failure as a parent if your child is growing away from you, and that's what Kat has to come to learn to accept.
I think that would be very comforting words to many listeners. As we talk about your own personal experiences, Elizabeth, you've mentioned and I've mentioned your journalistic background. Through Kat Conway, what did you want to say about the state of professional journalism?
Yeah, go out there and subscribe to a newspaper, people. Doesn't have to be a paper newspaper or a magazine or any kind of news outlet. There's a real crisis going on in journalism, not just in this country, but in the world. And I think it's terrifying, and I think it will affect our democracies, and it will affect the fabric that joins us together. And small newspapers, I adore small newspapers. When, I would go visit my in-laws when they lived in the country, and I would get the local paper, and it was all filled with, stories about upcoming dances and somebody's garbage can had been stolen. And I loved every minute. I always loved small newspapers. I don't want to be a complete doom and gloom person on this because lots of local news outlets are A, thriving and B, being created. I could name like 20 of them right now. The Local News Research Project is a great resource for this and tells you what is dying and what's surviving. So in the long term, I'm not worried about journalism because I think it will survive, but it might not be printed on dead trees is the only thing. Mm-hmm. And this novel, I think, was an homage, though, to the local newspaper, which is still printed on dead trees, and its fundamental importance to communities.
Kate, Kat is somebody who is forced to a big midlife pivot. As we've been suggesting, what did you want readers to take away from how she navigates all these changes in her life?
So I'm, as you mentioned, a therapist, and the constituency that I mostly work with is a midlife population that's struggling with the transformations that happen physically, emotionally, spiritually at that age. And I love midlife. I love it for myself. I love it for the people I work with because it does represent such a moment where change is possible, where people have really the ability to harvest kind of all the wisdom and experiences that they've gained up to that point and try to do something new if they can find the courage to push themselves beyond the known world, right? And I love that Kat is in that moment, that it's she really represents that tension of terror that the whatever change she reaches for might not work out. And you see that in her financial anxiety and in her anxiety about her son and her housing and various other things in her life that maybe aren't going as well as they might. But you also see in her a growing ambition, right? Maybe I could make that leap. Maybe there is another stage left for me where I could really do something amazing. And I think a lot of people stand at that inflection point at midlife, and it can be quite an exciting time, although culturally we think about it as sort of a moribund, depressing time. But I, in my experience and in the people I work with, it's a very rich in possibility.
Elizabeth, last question to you. I mentioned out of the gate that this is the first book in a series, so I wanted to ask you what is next in the Quillen Packet mystery novel series.
Yes, we are working on the next book right now. All of the titles we're hoping will be sort of puns on journalism or journalistic terms. So it's called Widows and Orphans, which is a term from typesetting. And it is set at a wellness conference. And the Quillen Packet is still limping along with all of our favorite characters there. But a variety of interesting and terrible things happen.
All right. Well, I should let you live in the moment of this book right now, but that's very nice to hear about. But good luck with everything that is coming your way with this book. It was a wonderful read.
Thank you so much for having us.
Really appreciate it. It's a thrill to be here.
Kate Hilton and Elizabeth Renzetti are the authors of Bury the Lead.
Hi, I'm Garrett Nealis, and I am from Winnipeg, Manitoba, and currently living in Toronto, Ontario. Right now, I'm reading a book called Songwriting Without Boundaries by Pat Pattison. So the book is actually, they're everyday lyric writing exercises for finding your own lyric writing voice. The gist of these exercises are to start, really tapping into the visual, the sensation, the sight, the taste, the touch of these moments that you're describing. And they're going to really help kind of identify these moments, these circumstances that you reflect upon when you're writing. You know, for anybody that's ever tried journaling before or just, you know, meditation and those types of things, try and find a little more presence in the moment. Descriptive writing, sensory writing is such a great exercise to kind of develop an awareness for your own self and for everything going on in your life. You know, there's inspiration everywhere. You just got to be paying attention, right? And I'm not just talking about writing or songwriting inspiration. I'm talking about inspiration for what your next move is career-wise, or, you know, inspiration for relationships that you want to be in or types of friends you want to surround yourself with. Something as simple as, you know, taking 10 minutes, 15 minutes out of your day to just do some sensory writing and, you know, really touch on what's going on in your life or what's going on in the moments around you can really help with that development of awareness.
We'll be back after these messages.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Cory Doctorow, author of The Bezel, and you're listening to The Next Chapter on CBC Radio 1.
Novelists love to set up challenges for their characters, and Louisa Onome sets up a doozy for the Nigerian-Canadian family at the center of her novel, Pride and Joy. When the grandmother and matriarch of this huge family doesn't wake up one day, there are some family members convinced she will rise again, like Jesus on Easter Sunday. The novel is funny and touching and filled with plenty of boisterous family dynamics. Our contributor Ryan B. Patrick spoke with Louisa about Pride and Joy, and here is their conversation.
You are known more for your YA novels, titles such as Like Home, Twice as Perfect. I met you back in 2022 at the Toronto International Festival of Authors. You did an on-stage interview, and then I kind of talked to you afterwards. And you were talking about your books, how they involve teens exploring identity and coming of age. And now with this new book, it's Pride and Joy. It's an adult comedy centered around your own Nigerian-Canadian heritage. Maybe talk about that, making that transition from YA to adult, and then why you write leaning in on your heritage.
It's funny. For me, I think that transition, in my mind, I kind of built it up a lot that it was going to be so different from what I did before. But I found that as I was writing Pride and Joy, it really just did feel like a natural extension, I guess, of what I had been doing. And for me, leaning on my heritage, because it's such an integral part of me, it just felt like, oh, if I'm going to write something new with a new sort of like demographic readership in mind, that I was just going to lean on something that I felt I knew and had experienced really intimately, just, you know, growing up in the Toronto area, Nigerian Canadian, and being in the community and just having different personalities around me all the time. And so leading into it was definitely a little bit nervous, but as I kind of got into it and started writing, I was like, wow, like it doesn't feel, I guess, as scary or as insurmountable as it did prior.
But let's talk about the story. So it's a novel, Pride and Joy, and it opens with a birthday that happens on the same day as the Good Friday holiday and the holiday weekend. So it's for Mama Mary. She's the matriarch. She's celebrating her 70th birthday. Who is Mama Mary at the start of this book?
Oh, man. She's the matriarch of the family. She's one of the protagonists, Joy. She's her mother. And I describe her a lot as just like a kind woman who has always kind of tried her hardest. She's been there for her family. They're gathering at kind of this like rental home sort of thing just to celebrate her and bring the family together.
Mm. So the party is organized by her daughter, Joy, who is a very interesting character. She's a life coach. She's divorced. Her own life is kind of in shambles in many respects. Who is Joy?
I really wanted to make sure that if I had like an intro character to this story, I wanted her to be someone who was decently relatable, not incredibly perfect, and kind of had this personality where as the story goes on, you could see like she's a little bit neurotic. She's always kind of trying to do her best for the sake of other people, always kind of looking outward, not always taking time to look inward and that sort of thing. So yeah, she definitely tries her hardest, but sometimes falls short.
Yeah. So it's the Okafor family. It's three generations of this Nigerian-Canadian family. So the party's just getting started. Mama Mary goes up to take a nap, but she doesn't wake up. And it's the grandchildren that find her first. What was it like writing those scenes?
Yeah, it was scary. And I only say that because all the grandkids are 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, that sort of thing. And then to have them walk into this room with somebody who I think maybe a lot of people feel this way about like our grandparents. It's like we know that they are a bit older, but you do kind of just feel like they're frozen in time that way and that there isn't anything that can or will change about them. So for the kids to walk into that room and see their grandmother unresponsive is a little bit terrifying. And so I wanted to really lean into just that eeriness of something about it feels off, like it feels like there's not a lot of air in the room, for example, or like, oh, it feels kind of dark or just things like that. And I really tried to focus on just that eerie feeling of when you enter a space and you're like, there's something off here.
So there's so much to unpack here, Louisa. You're talking about like death, grief. There's elements of comedy, elements of farce. I've seen the novel described as Black Cake meets Death at a Funeral. So it's set around the birthday, a death, and also a potential resurrection, question mark. So Mary's sister, Nancy, believes that Mary will rise again on Easter Sunday, like you know who. Why would she think that?
That's for on one hand, that is just the type of person that Nancy is. And I definitely wrote her with a lot of my a lot of my aunts in mind, like people I've grown up with and known and have met here and there. But one thing with the novel, and I really tried to illustrate it with Nancy's character as well, is that I really wanted to talk about, or at least explore, how culture and faith and spirituality all kind of work together, particularly in Nigerian culture as I have experienced it. Just in the sense that you can say, like, we're in a Christian home, we grew up in a Christian home, but there are still certain things that, you know, I would like ask my parents, like, why do we do this? That doesn't seem in line with what I understand of like the family's faith and everything. And then they would say things like, well, that's just our culture. Like, that's just what we do. And so I was really interested in just how these two things can coexist and what, if any, friction exists in a space with two things that can be kind of separate. And so with Nancy, very religious woman. And so the first thing she thinks is like, well, this has to mean something. And of course, it's like Good Friday. It's like, yeah, of course, this must be what it means. On one hand, I think a bit of it for her definitely is grief. And so that is just her way of dealing with it.
And I really enjoyed that aspect of the book. It's kind of like a lens into the Nigerian-Canadian community, which is a large and vibrant one in Canada, particularly Ontario, where this novel is set. I understand that Nigerians identify by their tribe instead of the country. So you have Yoruba or Igbo primarily. How does that dynamic play out in this book?
So the family, they are Igbo tribe, but Nancy is married a man and he's Yoruba. And so it's kind of like both tribes exist with each other and have kind of melded this sort of new tradition. So my family, we are, my mom is Ika and my dad is Isoko. And so we know people who are the same tribe as them. We know people who are other tribes. And I think I really just wanted to include that diversity of tribe in the book because, at least for me and my friends here, Nigerian Canadian friends, it's just kind of our reality. Like, I think it would be different had we all been in Nigeria. Like, there's one thing that my mom can like hear someone's last name and she knows exactly where they're from, what village they're from, where their family's from, all that kind of stuff. But for me, I'm just like, oh, I hear someone's last name and I'm like, oh, they're probably this tribe. And so I think that's why I wanted to include that diversity of tribe and lean on it a little bit more for the book.
This family feels so big and sprawling, like a big Italian family or a big Greek family. And then there's elements of farce, like I mentioned, there's comedy. And then it's like, is Mary going to actually be resurrected on Sunday? We don't know. So the characters get caught up in this. And then there's a host of a Nigerian-Canadian TV show who arrives at the house to kind of film this potential resurrection. So there's this ticking clock as we count down to Easter Sunday. How much fun was it kind of writing these scenes?
Oh, gosh, it was so much fun. It was a lot of fun just because I really got to lean into the absurdity that I witness, I think, on a like fairly often, definitely when I was younger and I would go to like parties, especially with a lot of family friends and like people that I didn't really know, but would just kind of be around. And then you just, you know, as a kid, you just overhear things. Even now as an adult, I'm always eavesdropping and always just like listening to things. And so it was a lot of fun to just be like, yeah, this group of adults who maybe from the outside, you'd think like, for sure, they have to have this together, but they're still trying to figure it out. And like, oh, you know, it's what has happened is potentially a tragedy ? Like on that unsure, like what to believe, where to fall on that spectrum. But there's still that kind of sensational aspect of like, this is probably going to be really important. We have to tell everyone. We have to put it on TV. Like, yeah, there might be something really big about to happen and wanting people to know that. And that just kind of all comes from, once again, like the people I've grown up around. And, you know, it's just like the environment and how I've been kind of observing people.
Speaking of observing people, I understand that you have a master's degree in counseling psychology and you're at one time a registered psychotherapist. In your stories, you have a knack for writing deeply flawed characters and even unlikable characters that we kind of grow to love or at least identify with. What's the key to writing flawed characters in your mind?
I think the key to writing flawed characters, really good flawed characters, is just really accepting the fact that, first of all, like, we all have good and bad things about us, and really coming to an acceptance about that. And so whenever I look at, for example, Joy's character and how I described her before is like, oh, she's a little bit neurotic, like she's kind of like this, you know, but I don't think any of those things are inherently bad things. I think that's just how she is. And so it's just like playing into the fact that, yeah, we all have these complicated emotions, maybe traits that we're not always so proud of, and bringing those to the forefront as opposed to, you know, hiding them or making them seem like they're not worth showing.
So speaking of complications, let's talk about Joy, the main protagonist. She has a son whose name is Jamil. A husband or ex-husband is named David. He's actually Italian, which makes Jamil mixed race, Nigerian-Italian. So tell me about this dynamic in terms of Joy, David, Jamil. What's happening here?
Well, from Joy's perspective, it's definitely complicated. I think from both of their perspectives, to be fair. They don't hate each other, her and David. And that seems to be what makes it more complicated in the eyes of her family. And Jamil even has a bit of not like an issue, but for him, it's a little bit complicated to just wrap his mind around, because you'd think like a breakup means something bad has happened or something like that. But for Joy especially, she's just like, yeah, we're just different people. Like we grew up, we grew differently, and that's fine. But at the same time, there is still a bit of weirdness around it. Her family in general, but her mom in particular, was always like, I don't believe in divorce. Like, I don't know what you're doing. Like, I don't understand this. And would still refer to David as like her husband. And so obviously after the initial part of the story where they find out that Mama Mary has passed away, Joy starts feeling a little bit more of that guilt, that she's like, oh man, like maybe we should still be married for the sake of her mother, you know, and just a lot of conflicting feelings with that.
So Louisa, I don't want to give too much away, but Pride and Joy, it deals with the nature of grief and how we process it. Why is that something you wanted to explore in fiction?
Yeah, I think grief is such a tricky thing to talk about in general. And it was just something I was interested in exploring for myself and writing my way through. And so I chose kind of a little bit of an absurd situation, but really just wanted to get to the heart of the matter, where it's like, what do you do when there's a loss? Like, what exactly do you do about it? And there's like the practical aspects, like we got to get this in order, we got to do that, whatever. But then there's the emotional aspect that for many people, it doesn't go away immediately. And it could take months, weeks, years to kind of really process and go through. And I don't know, I think I just had a lot of feelings about that, a lot of questions for myself, because it's such a common thing. But for the most part, societally, I don't think we talk about it enough, or we examine it enough, or like even push it to the forefront. Like, it's kind of always seemed as something you just kind of you put behind you and you're like, that's fine. But I was also kind of interested in exploring it a bit, especially from the lens of my culture, because there's a lot of really interesting grieving practices that at least I've witnessed. Certain things where if somebody is grieving, like a woman will, she'll like shave her head and she kind of has like that year to grieve, like that sort of thing. And I don't know, I was just fascinated by the ways in which people grieve in different cultures, in community, oftentimes, sometimes in isolation and things like that. And I just wanted to write my way through it and try and understand it a little bit better.
Louisa, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
That was Ryan B. Patrick in conversation with Louisa Onome about her novel, Pride and Joy. Imagine the plot possibilities when you gather a group of young people together in a hothouse atmosphere of ambition and ideas, and add to this a liberal sprinkling of sex, competition, and drama. Mix those ingredients all together, and you've got the makings of a campus novel. From secret societies to sexual politics and academic infighting, stories centered on university life are the gift that keeps on giving. Our colleague Talia Cleott is an associate producer at CBC Books, and someone who's a lot closer to her university years than me. And she joins me now to tell us about three campus novels she recommends. Hi, Talia. Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Tell me this. Before you went to university, were you reading campus novels almost like as prep for what to expect?
Yeah, totally. I think just as soon as I was able to read, I was very interested in what university would be like. Mm. And then, of course, I got there and it was a global pandemic. So I was doing it all from my basement for a lot of it. So even while I was in university, I was kind of reading them as a with like a little bit of longing.
What could have been?
Like, what could have been?
Now that you know university life, or at least I hope some of your university life lived up to, what do you think makes it such a rich source for material for these novelists in particular?
I think a lot of it is that people are branching out of the communities that they've grown up in. And like this, like age 18 to 22, 24, 20, whatever, is just an age of, you know, growth, coming of age. There's so everyone's making mistakes, but everyone's doing it. Mm. So it's not really like so bad. Everyone's learning. And also there's just like an arrogance and an idealism of youth, which I mean, maybe I have, I hope not, but it makes for great satire. So
arrogance not coming through right now. I don't see it or hear it, but you are a fountain of information. You've got three books, as I mentioned. So tell us, what's the first one you want to talk about today?
The first one is Come and Get It by Kylie Reid.
Okay. What kind of university atmosphere do we enter in Come and Get It?
So it's set in 2017 at the University of Arkansas, and it's largely in a dorm building, specifically for upperclassmen, scholarship, or transfer students. And the main character is 24-year-old Millie. She's a senior, and she's working as a resident assistant in the dorm building. So basically, she's taking care of all the students in the dorm, making sure that they have what they need. But she's done with university. She wants to be an adult. She wants to buy a house. She wants to get a job. So those kind of tensions are coming into play. But she's also just, she really cares a lot about the students and making their experience as good as possible. So it's quite interesting.
Her age is interesting because at 24, you mentioned she's done with university. I would think, yeah, at 24, you are done. Even the university is probably like, aren't you done?
Yeah,
here?
She took a gap year.
She took a gap year to
care for a sick parent. So she's a real salt of the earth type of gal.
Oh, very nice. Now, besides her, who are the other students we meet that live in this dorm?
Yeah, so she shares a room with three students that kind of become the center of all chaos. Tyler is one of them. She's a smooth-talking, not overconfident. She honestly, her confidence is pretty merited. She's a little bit manipulative. There's Peyton. She's comes from a very sheltered family. She loves cooking, but she's also the only other Black student in the dorm other than Millie. So the race issue also comes into play a bit. And Kennedy, she's the last roommate, and she's an insecure transfer student, and she's reeling from a very awful accident that happened at her prior school. She kind of just comes in to this new school kind of hoping things will be better. The writing is honest but not judgmental. It paints a real picture of them and like a real and fair picture of the characters. It's not mean, but it's also funny.
Hmm. What I know about campus novels, there's a blurring of lines of, you think you're somebody, but you're capable of doing so much more. There's professors who overstep boundaries. That's a common theme in campus novels. How's that handled in this book?
Yeah, so there's definitely a professor who crosses quite a few boundaries in this. Her name is Agatha Paul. She's a visiting professor, and she's coming to the university to write a book about marriage ideals and how, you know, young women see themselves in that. So she goes to the dorm, and she offers Millie, you know, $20 to get a group of girls together to talk about it. And while she talks to them, she gets really fascinated by their conversations that have to do with like money and, you know, the nonchalant ways that they talk about what they have and what they don't have and the sense of privilege that really shines through from some of these students. And so Agatha becomes really fascinated with this, and she kind of strikes up a deal with Millie that she'll come to the dorm once a week, she'll pay Millie, and then she'll eavesdrop on these girls. Hmm. And she's not actually writing a book in the end. She ends up kind of crafting these personas, not really so well journalistically at all, and writing these profiles called the Money Diaries and selling them to Teen Vogue. And as you can probably imagine, it kind of doesn't go the way she hopes when you're, you know, making stuff up, you know, shifting the truth, and also the aspect of paying Millie to have her there is a little shady, so.
Yeah, there's a mole in the organization.
Yeah.
All right, what is the next book on your list?
The next book is The Red Word by Sarah Henstra.
Okay, who are the students in this book? What do they get up to?
So I'd say like the main tension and the main student is Karen. She's a sophomore and she's kind of really torn between two worlds, that of GBC, which is a frat where she parties and she's dating one of the brothers, and then that of Raghurst. It's the house where she lives. And at Raghurst, there are just a bunch of intellectual, feminist, and unapologetically spirited young women. And she's kind of juggling these two things that she kind of desperately wants to be a part of both, more so the women of Raghurst, but she's also just so involved in this frat, which kind of stands for everything that these women are against.
Well, it's very interesting. You wouldn't hear a frat, a fraternity, and this Raghurst type of place usually in the same sentence, right? But I think universities are very polarized places, maybe these days more than, or maybe they always are, but how does that clash of, you know, feminism versus frat culture work out?
It's super interesting the way that Sarah Henstra handles it because, so Diane, she's kind of the ringleader of Raghurst and she really wants to bring down GBC, which is like also nicknamed Gangbang Central. Like it has a horrible reputation and she wants to take it down as a symbol of rape culture. And like rightfully so, it's known for many really gross and shady practices. But while Raghurst side stands for a different thing, the way that she tries to take them down is also kind of shady and gross. So in the end, the kind of two houses get into sort of a war, not really like college movie wars where, like, you know, you're throwing water balloons at each other, but also kind of like an ideological war with protests and everything. And in the end, it comes with quite a horrible price.
How does the theme of Greek life weave through the book?
So it's really smart the way she plays with this because we have the frat boys who embody, you know, Greek life in like the Greek fraternity culture sense of the term. And then the women of Raghurst, they're really, really enthralled with the study of Greek life in the classical sense and analyzing, you know, Greek texts and Greek practices through a feminist lens. And they even like perform some of the rituals sometimes, similarly to like the way the boys are performing these frat boy rituals. And there's satire on both sides in a way that really like makes you think about the two groups, but also firmly stands against rape culture as it should.
Okay. And what is the final book on your list today?
Bunny by Mona Awad.
Mm-hmm. What aspects of university life does Mona Awad take on in Bunny? This is the one that I'm familiar with out of the three.
It's a good one. So it looks at Samantha. She's a creative writer's master student at an elite New England university. And it kind of gives you a look into graduate school with a small cohort and a deeper look into academia itself and what it means to be part of an academic institution at a high level like that.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about the title. Who are the bunnies in the title?
So they're a supremely cliquey group of beautiful, wealthy women who are part of Samantha's cohort, her workshop group. At the beginning, she really does not get along with him. She kind of cringes with the way that they all call each other Bunny in like a weird sexual friendship type of way. And one day she gets invited to their monthly smut salon and she becomes more involved with them. She joins their off-campus workshop. And once she does that, the lines of their fiction versus reality kind of blur and their creations come to haunt them in a very horror-esque way.
You mentioned satire when you were talking about The Red Word. How does Mona Awad satirize the creative writing world, this slice of academia?
Well, I mean, I can kind of speak to some similar experiences in my undergrad. My minor was creative writing, so I was in these type of workshops quite a bit, maybe not to the same extent, but it's very vulnerable. You're sharing like the earliest drafts of your writing, but sometimes they're complete strangers, and they're essentially just there to judge you. And so in these spaces, really intense friendships form, just kind of like the bunnies. But also the politics play into, you know, whose stories you like and whose story you don't like. And you can kind of see, like, the people who are friends with each other sometimes will always give nice comments about each other's stories and stuff like that. But also, like, the lines of fiction and reality are often really blurred in these spaces where people are learning to write. There's a lot of, like, thinly veiled autobiography. So it was super interesting to see the way the more fantastical elements of the writing in Bunny actually, they come to life in that way for real, too. So
campus novels, whether you're preparing for life on campus one day, whether you're on campus or longing for that life, these are books that are just entertaining for all reading demographics from what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and I think maybe there's also a sense of nostalgia, too, if you're reading them at a different point in your life and you're looking back on your years and you're like, oh, well, I wouldn't have made a mistake like that, but maybe you actually did.
All right. Thanks, Talia.
Thanks so much.
Talia Cleott is an associate producer at CBC Books. The titles she recommended are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. And that is it for today's program. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews. My thanks this week to Laura Antonelli, Olivia Pasquarelli, Barb Carey, and to the CBC Books digital team. Coming up next week, international bestseller Shilpi Somaya Gowda and her page-turning and provocative new novel, A Great Country. It follows a close-knit Indian-American family after their son has a violent encounter with police. It's an event that raises all kinds of questions for the family and for the reader as well. And Cole Nowicki, the author of the essay collection Laser Quit Smoking Massage, talks with our contributor Ryan B. Patrick. I'm Ali Hassan. Thanks for listening to The Next Chapter.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.